Hello there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. We have with us Robbie Suave. Robbie was here several months ago to talk about the Covington Boys episode. He's an editor at Reason Magazine and a columnist for the Daily Beast. He appears frequently in major newspapers across the country and was in 2017-18 a Novak Fellow at the Fund for American Studies. He has a new book out entitled Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. Welcome, Robbie.
Thanks for having me. Great to speak with you.
Well, let's jump right into the book. You begin with an interesting contrast, and that is the response to election night 2008 and election night 2016, particularly among the young. And this is a springboard for really the main topic of the book. What happened on those two nights?
Right. I mean, the contrast, obviously, between the election of Barack Obama and Donald Trump to the presidencies. It's not no surprise, right, that young people greeted these two events quite differently. I was on campus at the University of Michigan in 2008.
Still a student.
So I was still a student at the time. I was working for the student newspaper, the Michigan Daily, which is the main left, far left of center paper. I was actually the opinion page editor, so I had a lot of fun. It was sort of my job to write these editorials that I completely disagreed with. I mean, I was a libertarian even then. Although I think that's a good experience for a person, to work at formulating the best arguments, even if you disagree with them. Anyway, it was kind of a formative experience for me. Everybody ran out the night of the election when it was clear that Obama had won. Everyone, ran out of the building. There was partying in the streets. I was like the only one left actually putting together the paper because I was kind of indifferent about who won.
You quote some of your peers at the time, and the adulation, the exhilaration, was extraordinary.
Right. Right. They were, and they, young people had done a lot to help Obama get elected. Young, politically interested people often do a lot of the legwork of campaigning. They do voter registration drives. They do, kind of the grunt work, especially those who want to get experience in political advocacy. So they felt like they had a hand in this. So then to contrast it with, 8 years later, it's no surprise, but it was like a bomb had gone off, or there had been a mass shooting, or a genocide, the way students reacted on campuses. It was as if the trauma they had experienced. I mean, there were campuses that canceled classes that hadn't even canceled classes after like 9/11. There were, this is the title of my book, Panic Attack, because I talk a lot about how their activism and their frustration with the state of the world always goes back, and they make it go back to their mental health, which is front and center of their activism. So this was depression.
Yeah, you use the term that the election was, quote, psychologically scarring. It wasn't just a political loss, and you live in a republic, and things go up and down. Elections, the fortunes of parties rise and fall. But this wasn't political; it was much deeper for them.
Right. It was psychological. It was spiritual to the extent the cohort I'm discussing, really, spirituality is even really a thing for them. But it was about their mental wellness, so that you had cry-ins and safe spaces, and the college officials were sending emails like, the mental health services are available to you, please visit the psychological services, an invitation that all colleges often make very open. There's just this increased emphasis on mental wellness on campuses that I think has almost gone too far in some ways, and we can get into that. But it was a psychological event.
And one added factor that you talk about early in the book that demonstrates how powerful this was is that you say that activists generally on campus have much more power now than they did even 15 years ago. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that's the case. And It's because it's not. So it's not because their numbers have really increased. It's because their demands are being taken seriously. They have achieved more power situationally, and people have started or did start listening to them over the last couple of years, giving them what they want or being afraid to speak out against them. So when they would, you know, make demands that, well, we don't want this person speaking on campus, we're going to shut them down if they do come to campus, we're going to threaten violence, we're going to, you know, we're going to riot. And this is a small number of people saying this at prestigious liberal arts colleges. And everyone else didn't really know how to react and has allowed these things to take place. The administrations they're divided. Some members of the administration want to meet the students' demands because probably they're ideologically sympathetic. Some are not really ideologically sympathetic, but just have no idea how to handle them and think that giving them exactly what they want was kind of the best way, that it would be. I think they worry there'll be too many public relations complications for not satisfying student demands. Of course, they've learned that there are public relations complications for giving the students everything they want, because there's a whole lot of people who think, you know, violence against Charles Murray or trying to stop Ben Shapiro from speaking or having your own professors investigated for having offended you, that this kind of insanity is terrifying and must end. So I think we have actually started to see a pushback maybe in the last year or so. But it's been, you know, and this is not these tactics of the young radicals. These illiberal tactics have been deployed against conservatives, but they've actually been deployed against liberals as well. Even people of the considerably to the left, the professors, the faculty, have been the great losers in the power dynamic of campus over the last 20 years. The faculty's power, which I think is a bad thing, because I think of the group that should have power on campus, it should probably be the faculty. Their power they've lost power relative to the students and the administration. And many of them tell me, they told me in private conversations and research background for this book, that they fear their students. Not all their students, not most of their students, just a couple students. They're afraid if they say something in class that would have been perfectly acceptable on leftist grounds until like yesterday, but maybe it's just not the exactly correct language that millennial Gen Z activists use, that they will offend some student, and there will be an investigation of the professor immediately after the class ends. The student will go directly to the administration, and there will be an investigation of this faculty member. And they're right to fear this, because it has happened over and over again. And this has been the most troubling consequence of the kind of tactics I'm criticizing in the book.
And I think when I hear people downplay the seriousness of that anxiety on the part of professors, they underestimate the fact that all you need is a couple of well-publicized occasions in which a professor who was very innocently, you know, maybe he was in a free speech class, he used the N-word in an entirely scholarly, instructional fashion, but he gets hauled up. Nonetheless, it only takes one publicized incident like that for a whole lot of other people to take a lesson. And that's the chill effect, right?
Exactly. And it only takes one. And there has been 10 of exactly what you just described, of an offensive language being used in the classroom, but for a scholarly purpose, for an explicitly, you know, discussing in a literature class the poems or the works of a black author who used the word. It's in their writings. And, you know, this is being discussed by a teacher who has, you know, an expertise and affinity for this person and their work. You know,
it was James Baldwin, right?
Right. James Baldwin is often the one who has prompted this. And, you know, he writes about uncomfortable subjects, but we should be able to discuss those in the classroom. And again, not all the students, but a couple students have absolutely weaponized the kinds of increasingly formal protections for feelings that the campuses have put into formal rules. And they have turned these on the professors so that and professors are not particularly courageous people. A couple of them are, you know, a couple have made heroic stands against this kind of thing. But it has often, look what happened to the Weinsteins at Evergreen. You know, look what happened to Laura Kipnis. There's pariah status is what greets you for publicly denouncing the illiberal tactics of a couple radical students.
Now, this gets to maybe one of the core theses of the book, Panic Attack, and that is that you say that the form or the content, the tactics of today's protests actually undermine the progressive goals of the protesters. People recoil when they see things, the actual behavior of the students. I want to get to, now, but before you go into that thesis, I want to say, I mean, for your research for this book, what you did was you pretty much just sat at your computer, you looked at the screen, you stayed home, you made coffee, you stayed in your pajamas, and you took what your evidence from blogs and websites, correct?
I did some of that. I also visited a lot of campuses to actually discuss with the students at the protests. You know, I would show up when one of the big incidents I got a lot of useful material from was a attempted shutdown of Charles Murray at the University of Michigan. So I knew he was speaking there. So I went there. I put on my clothes. I got dressed. I think I probably brought a coffee with me. But I interviewed the kind of students who said that they wanted to shut him down.
But what I want to tell our listeners is one of the great things about Panic Attack is you got out there, you talked to hundreds of people, you went to different campuses, you witnessed events, you knew things were going to happen before they happened, and you got there on the ground. And I think the real strength of this book, one of the things that separates it from a lot of the general discussions of campus protest and youth social justice movements, is the fact of your eyewitness work. You saw, you heard, and you wrote down, and you talked to people. You got out there, and there are many vivid occasions in the book. The events really come alive. I want to salute you for that. The reportage is excellent. So look, let's use some of that material to explain exactly how self-defeating so many of these protests are.
Right. So I didn't want this to be just another book bashing the left is so intolerant, because there's been a lot of that commentary. Often that commentary is good. Sometimes it's a little overly broad, and it's, you know, ignoring the also there's plenty of anti-speech activism on the right as well. So I wanted to actually add to our understanding of what's happening in this moment. If the book can be distilled down to one kind of key insight from discussing with these students, it was that they are not thinking about the tactics they're using as social change tactics, which is how I was thinking about them, you know, before I talked with these people. I was thinking, you know, shouldn't you not do this because, you know, if you're shutting down Charles Murray or Ben Shapiro or whatever, you're not even letting them speak. Don't you think most people will become more sympathetic to the speaker because you're denying them and are going to think you're very sensitive and you're too easily offended, and this is not a good strategy, was my thinking.
Who are the bullies here?
Right, exactly. So because that's how I would react. You know, you're not even letting this person talk. You know, you're afraid of what they have to say. That doesn't make your position look very very persuasive. But they would tell me they're not thinking about it in those terms. They for them, it's about safety. It's about their ever broadening conception of what safety entails. For them, safety, a dynamic of safety, an aspect of safety, is emotional well-being, is psychological stability. And if you are going to bring someone to campus who is going to say things that make someone a contingent of the marginalized community to which the activists are sympathetic, if it makes them feel unwell emotionally, then it's as if you have introduced a kind of violence. This is almost like a weird kind of co-opting of like the libertarian non-aggression principle. They're saying that you have done the aggression because you are you are causing to happen speech that impugns someone's safety because it makes them feel unwell. So we are justified in preventing that from happening, in some cases with violence, because you have already started violence. So what we're doing is self-defense. That's a, and I think that's a very important thing for people who want to critique these tactics to understand, because the, you know, because my whole, well, you shouldn't do this because this is going to turn people off and this is, you know, this is unpersuasive, this is bad activism, is not what they're about. They are about safety. That is the central concern that animates some of the craziness that we're seeing.
You actually call it, quote, repressive safety.
Right. It's repressive because it's infantilizing, and it then positions as something that must be cast aside some of the most like sacred liberal values in an Enlightenment liberal or classical liberal sense, namely free speech and due process, which are two things I talk a lot about in the book, how the new leftist activism is just very hostile to these two concepts. Four reasons of the expansion of safety. When the left was historically very good on these things, you know, the ACLU kind of left, to which, from which many of the faculty come, which explains part of this hostility between faculty and students. The older left, and even the older campus left. I mean, you know, I talk a lot about in the book about Berkeley, birthplace of the free speech movement. You know, often there was very radical activism back then. There was even in some cases violent activism by some standards more violent than what we've seen today. But it was in its own way very pro free speech. Even the very far left students, they did not want the administrations on campuses to have rules about who could speak. They fought those rules tooth and nail. They challenged them by bringing, they would invite the controversial speakers. Actually, there's an incident I recount in my book that I discovered for research for it, that in 1963, the far left students of Berkeley actually invited a literal Nazi, like a member of the Nazi party, to speak on campus. Not only did they invite him to speak, they dressed in full Nazi regalia to promote the event, the leftist students did. And nobody shut down the guy, nobody even heckled him. They just laughed. They just laughed when he was done speaking, and then he went on his way. And this was, you know, 20 years after World War II, so after, like, Nazis were an existential threat to, like, planet Earth. And now, if you try to do this now, decades and decades and decades removed from the threat of Nazism, it would be like there had been a genocide on campus. They would shut down the campus. There would be a week of mourning nationwide. So that's how the activism has changed.
Didn't Saul Alinsky once say that ridicule is the best weapon?
I think he did. Did he?
I think. But what you said a moment ago, you laugh at them.
Right.
This to me is one of the successes of the 60s, that kind of antic form of protest that would ridicule the opposition to make it seem unserious, to bring it down. And I think it actually worked very well. Now, you mention an anecdote to go back in time of Richard Nixon when one of his aides said, you know, the campus protests, the students, they're going to go crazy over you doing something. And Nixon said, good. And I presume that's because he believed that this would push a little more of that silent majority over in his voting block. Is the same thing, do you think, happening for Trump?
I absolutely think that. There's some social science research showing, for instance, that civil protests can work, but that that illiberal or uncivil or violent protests backfire because they make people more sympathetic to whatever the authority figure is in the society. They end up wanting the kind of like law and order regime that someone like Nixon or someone like Trump is or was advocating. You know, I truly do think, and there has been more recent kind of survey studies. I've seen enough to indicate that I think this certainly cannot be, at the very least, cannot be dismissed. The idea that there were people voting for Trump as a screw you to political correctness or to political correctness run amok and enforced by the left. I wrote about this right after the election, and I received, this was one of my most well-read articles, and I received so many emails from people, usually older people, saying, I voted for Trump for exactly that reason, or, you know, I've never voted before. I voted for Democrats before. I'm politically indifferent. But my God, if one more person tells me that I used the wrong pronoun or something like that in their personal experience, in their private experience or in their social media zone or wherever, that they said the wrong thing. Well, and these people would say, I don't know what the right thing is. I never went to college. You know, just being told I'm a racist or I'm a sexist or I, you know, for not understanding what has only become gospel to the left again 5 minutes ago. These things have,
the line keeps moving pretty quickly.
Right. And you need to be paying very close attention to know even what the right words are to say, even if you have absolutely no malice about these things. So I saw one survey that, aside from just being a Republican, the position most correlated with having supported Trump was thinking political correctness has gone too far. People hate political correctness. People hate formal and informal policing of language. They say this over and over again, no matter, and this is people on the right and the left hate it. Only like a small contingent of radical, you know, Oberlin grads think political correctness is a good thing. Everyone else hates it. And I certainly think this played well to Trump, who is the avatar of resistance to political correctness.
Now you interviewed Richard Spencer. Who is Richard Spencer and why did you interview him?
Sure. Richard Spencer is, I think, the intellectual leader of the alt-right, the new young white nationalist group. So this book is a survey of types of young, new radical groups, the activism that has proliferated in the Trump years, but not all of it is on the left. So I wanted to spend some time talking about the alt-right because they qualify. They are a new group. They didn't exist 10 years ago, and they're a group of mostly young people, and they're views are horrifying. They're an explicitly white nationalist group or white separatist group. So I wanted to interview Spencer about what their beliefs are and you know, make sure I give them the same. Because I don't want to just bash the left. The alt-right is a more horrifying group. I think their influence is limited because there aren't that many of them. And they I think their high watermark was probably, in terms of impact on our nation, was probably Charlottesville, and it has receded since then, thank goodness. So I interviewed him for the book and some people who have joined the alt-right, which is this, you know, they're very social media concentrated, and that has certainly been their domain, or their biggest impact has been just, you know, campaigns of really vile harassment of Jewish people and women and sort of everyone who, you know, who doesn't share their ideas.
And what was the main intellectual position that you got out of Spencer?
So Spencer calls himself an identitarian, and he says his movement is identitarian in that it doesn't so much recognize individual rights, or at least your rights do not come from the fact that you are an individual. It's a group. Spencer told me this, he has some affinity for the left's emphasis on identity politics. He thinks he disagrees with the right for dismissing the concept of identity politics. He thinks it makes perfect sense for the left to say, well, my meaning in life comes from me being a person of color or a gay person or a trans person, et cetera. He says he gets that. He says, as a white person, you should have that. That should be your identity. Isn't it great that you're a white person? And shouldn't we have policies to create kind of a white society? And of course, he, you know, tries to dress it up like he's not saying, well, I'm not saying anyone else is bad or wrong, or but shouldn't we have our own society too? They have their own thing. Doesn't that make more sense? It is a philosophy that sort of denies individuality, individual rights, which is my philosophy, which is libertarianism. I think to some degree, classical liberalism, certainly part of the intellectual trend of conservatism, is that, you know, your rights come because you are a person, you are a human being, and all human beings get equal rights, and that is, you know, that's kind of the fundamental. That takes precedence over everything else. Obviously, you can be part of a group, or some groups are voluntarily chosen, some are thrust upon you by virtue of your birth. But for Spencer, for the identitarian movement, for the alt-right, you being a white person is the most important thing about you. So he actually, so again, it's funny, there are some parallels here between the alt-right and the far left. I mean, we've seen them explicitly. There's streaks of anti-Semitism in both, both position Jewish people as, well, they control the media and the banks, and there's a criticism of capitalism on both sides. Both sides despise capitalism. And see that as tied up into Jewish people and anti-Semitism and so on. So it's and they're two extremes that absolutely feed off each other and need each other. Sometimes it's hard not to pay attention to them because their antics are so ridiculous and headline catching. We keep watching what's happening, for instance, in Portland between Antifa and this far right Patriot Prayer group, who are not, these are not exactly stand-ins for the alt right and the far left, but it's like 20 people keep wanting to beat each other up, and they're desperate to beat each other up, and I'm not sure what exactly should we even prevent, like the police are constantly being criticized for not preventing this, but like these two groups want to fight each other so badly, I'm not quite sure what the police should do.
Can we rent a stadium and just,
right, just, you know, have at it.
Right. Now, the later chapter here has a title, not LGBT, you have LGB versus T. What's with the verses?
So I wanted to explore some of the infighting on the left that is produced by the philosophy of intersectionality, which is so important to leftist activism. Intersectionality being a theory that is true. The theory is not, there's nothing wrong with the theory, that there are different sources of oppression. You can be oppressed because you're a black person or because you're a woman or for, 100 other reasons, and these are different and distinct, but then they also stack. So you can be more oppressed if you're a trans woman of color. You get it, like that. But then, of course, it posits that the oppressed themselves are the experts on their oppression, and they must be front and center when we're doing activism on those issues. But then also, you're not supposed to ask them to educate you, and since they're oppressed, it's wrong to thrust the spotlight on them if they're not comfortable with it. So activism based on intersectionality creates all these ridiculous contradictions that are totally self-defeating for the standpoint of forming a cohesive political movement, and also that. They're saying, well, we don't want to work with anyone who isn't intersectional, who doesn't agree with us on each and every one of these classifications, which is hard because there aren't that many people who are as far left as these far left activists. Many people agree with gay marriage or gay rights broadly, but the gender related activism, the things that contingent wants are beyond what a lot of people are ready to support. So this chapter specifically is about infighting between kind of the traditional gay equality activism and the gender equality activism, or the trans recognition.
Do you think that tension is serious enough to really threaten the coalition?
I think on these issues, this issue specifically, yes. I think I think there's certainly, the tension often spills out into the main. I often see writers who write about LGBT issues, or gay writers, or especially older gay writers who, come from kind of a different generation, or a generation where gay people didn't have the rights they have today, getting really annoyed at some of the kind of trans activists who want to pick fights with them, who are often the activists on transgender issues tend to make more sweeping and I think absurd and ridiculous arguments about anti-speech arguments than just about any other activist group I've ever encountered. This is not a condemnation of transgender people. The activists on this issue will routinely make claims like anything disagreeing with them at all is violence. You are literally causing trans people to die in the streets if you critique any aspect of their activism, and they're saying this not just to people on the right, but again, people who are supposedly in their own coalition. It's an explicitly, they're so anti-speech often. Even in my book, I interviewed a transgender activist who we have clashed many times, and even this person agreed with me, and I quote them in book for saying, okay, yes, there has been some utterly ridiculous and absurd activism on this issue.
And this goes along with your thesis that the tactics undermine the goals, at least the stated goals. But then so it means there's something else going on there. Let me get to one of the latter parts of the book. Final question. You talk about the Democratic Socialists of America, and they were a strong force for Bernie in 2016. The Democratic Party, the youth, really went toward him. Do you see that phenomenon a factor next year?
That's a good question. Certainly it's a factor. So the Democratic Socialists of America is the group to be feared of these groups I'm discussing. They are the one that is politically organized, that has had remarkable success. Their ranks have grown tremendously from about, I mean, this group has been around for decades. Its members, basically, it did not gain any members for like 30 years. Its members just got older because it was the same group of people. Their membership grew by thousands and thousands and thousands. The average age of a member dropped from like, you know, ancient to 30 something, or maybe even younger. The young people are very, very interested in democratic socialism. These people are certainly making their mark. AOC is their sort of greatest victory so far, and partly because how the right has treated her. She has become so well known to young people, to people on the left, even who are not democratic socialists. So certainly their goal is to have Bernie Sanders be the nominee. And there's, you know, the infighting here is between Sanders people and Warren people.
I was going to ask, are the young going to drift toward Warren if Bernie's not the candidate?
So, yes, they're very clear about this. Warren is the second best candidate there. But there, you know, there's I'd say they're split in about thirds. There's a third who's like Bernie or nothing. You know, Bernie represents radical change. You know, want everyone else, even Warren is a capitalist. Bernie is making a criticism of the system that is more fundamental than what anyone else is doing. So we're Bernie or bust. There's another third who are like, well, Bernie's better, but Warren's also good. We would happily support Warren. And there's probably another third that is just going to tune out completely if it's not one of those two. Certainly. So Bernie is absolutely the focus, but there are plenty of people who will support Warren if it's not him, which is seeming slightly more likely. Although I think the media supports Warren so totally that it distorts a lot. And this was my takeaway from 2016, was that the media could not even conceive of Trump winning. So it was just the way the race was covered was that just Hillary was guaranteed to win. So I'm trying to practice seeing through sort of media bias, and the media bias, it seems to me, based on the people I know, based on the coverage I see, is 100% pro Warren. So I think her chances are often being overestimated, or her chances at the nomination and in the general, because the people who write, who are kind of the loudest, who command, you know, the media culture, just love Warren.
The book is Panic Attack: Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you.